Freak the Mighty by Rodman Philbrick. Chapter 1. The Unvanquished Truth. I never had a brain until Freak came along and let me borrow his for a while. And that's the truth, the whole truth, the unvanquished truth, is how Freak would say it. And for a long time, it was him who did the talking. Except I had a way of saying things with my fists and my feet, even before he became Freak the Mighty, slaying dragons and fools and walking high above the world. Called me Kicker for a time. This was daycare, the year Graham and Grim took me over, and I had a thing about booting anyone who dared to touch me, because they were always trying to throw a hug on me like it was medicine I needed. Graham and Grim, bless their pointed little heads, they're my mother's people, her parents, and they figured, well, better put this little critter with other little critters his own age. Maybe it'll improve his temper. Yeah, right. Instead, what happened? I invented games like kickboxing and kick knees and kick faces and kick teachers and kick the other little daycare critters because I knew what a rotten lie that hug stuff was. Oh, I knew. That's when I got my first look at Freak, that year of the phony hugs. He didn't look so different back then. We were all of us pretty small, right? But he wasn't in the playroom with us every day. Just now and then he'd show up, looking sort of fierce, is how I remember him. Except later it was Freak himself who taught me that remembering is a great invention of the mind, and if you try hard enough, you can remember anything, whether it really happened or not. So maybe he wasn't really all that fierce in daycare. Except I'm pretty sure he did hit a kid with his crutch once, whacked the little brat pretty good, and for some reason, Little Kicker never got around to kicking Little Freak. Maybe it was those crutches kept me from lashing out at him. Man, those crutches were cool. I wanted a pair for myself. And when a little Freak showed up one day, with these shiny braces strapped to his crooked legs, metal tubes right up to his hips, why, those were even more cool than crutches. I'm Robot Man, Little Freak would go, making these weird robot noises as he humped himself around the playground. Like he had robot motors inside his legs, going, And this look like, don't mess with me, man. Maybe I got a laser cannon hidden inside these leg braces. Smoke a hole right through you. No question. Freak was hooked on robots even back then. This little guy 2 feet tall, and already he knew what he wanted. Then for a long time I never saw Freak anymore. One day he just never came back to daycare. And the next thing I remember, I'm like in the third grade or something, and I catch a glimpse of this yellow-haired kid scowling at me from one of those crippled vans. Man, they were death ray eyes. And I think, hey, that's him, the robot boy. And it was like, whoa, because I'd forgotten all about him. Daycare was a blank place in my head, and nobody had called me Kicker for a long time. Mad Max, they were calling me, or Max Factor, or this one butthead in LD class called me MaxiPad, until I persuaded him otherwise. Grammar and Grim always called me Maxwell, though, which is supposed to be my real name, and sometimes I hated that worst of all. Maxwell. Ugh. Grim out in the kitchen one night, after supper, whispering to Graham, had she noticed how much Maxwell was getting to look like him? Which is the way he always talked about my father, who had married his dear departed daughter and produced Maxwell. Grim never says my father's name, just him, like his name is too scary to say. It's more than just the way Maxwell resembles him, Grim says that night in the kitchen. The boys like him. We better watch out. You never know what he might do while we're sleeping. Like his father did. And Graham right away shushes him and says don't ever say that, because little pictures have big ears, which makes me run to the mirror to see if it's my big ears made me look like him. What a butthead, huh? Well, I was a butthead, because like I said, I never had a brain until Freak moved down the street. The summer before 8th grade, right? That's the summer I grew so fast that Grim said, we'd best let the boy go barefoot, he's exploding out of his shoes. That barefoot summer, when I fell down a lot, and the weirdo robot boy with his white-yellow hair and his weird fierce eyes moved into the duplex down the block, with his beautiful brown-haired mom, the fair Gwen of Air. Only a falling-down goon would think that was a real name, right? Like I said. Are you paying attention here? Because you don't even know yet how he got to be Freak the Mighty, which is pretty cool, even if I do say so myself. Chapter 2. Up from the Down Under. That summer, Let's see, I'm still living in the basement, my own private down under, in the little room Grim built for me there. Glued up this cheap paneling, right? It sort of buckles away from the concrete cellar walls, a regular ripple effect. But do I complain about the crummy paneling, or the rug that smells like low tide? I do not. Because I like it in the down under. Got the place all to myself, and no fear of Graham sticking her head in the door and saying, "Maxwell, dear, what are you doing?" Not that I ever do much of anything. Grim has it fixed in his head. I'm at a dangerous age, and they need to keep me under observation. Like I might make bombs or start a fire, or whack out the local pets with my trusty slingshot, or whatever. Except I never had a slingshot. It was Grim who had one when he was my age. The proof is right there in the family photo album. You can see this blurry little miniature Grim, with no front teeth, grinning at the camera, and yanking back on this prehistoric slingshot. Good for whacking mastodons, probably. Just proper targets, Grim says, closing up the photo album. End of discussion. Like, oops, better hide the evidence, don't want to give the dangerous boy any ideas. Not that I have any ideas. My brain is vacant, okay? I'm just this critter hiding out in the basement, drooling in my comic books or whatever. Alright, I never actually drool, but you get the picture. Anyhow, this is the first day of July, already counting down for the 4th and wondering where I can get an M80, which is supposed to have the explosive power of a quarter stick of dynamite or something, and when it goes off, your heart thuds to a stop for a microsecond. Wham. Which is probably what Grim is afraid of. Eek, eek, Maxwell armed with dynamite. So finally I get bored in the down under, and I'm hanging out in the so-called backyard, your basic chunk of chain link heaven. Grim keeps his crummy little mower in the shed, but what's the point of mowing dirt, right? Okay, I'm out there messing around, and that's when I see the moving van. Not your mainstream, nationwide, brand-name mover, either. Just some cheapo local outfit. These big bearded dudes in their sweaty undershirts lugging stuff into the duplex half that's been vacant since last Christmas, when the dope fiend who lived there finally got busted. At first, I'm thinking the dope fiend is back. He's out of jail or whatever, and he's moving his stuff back in. Then I see the fair Gwen. Not that I knew her name. That was a little while later. At first, she's a glimpse. Caught her going between the van and the front door, talking to the beards. I'm thinking, hey, I know her. And then I'm thinking, no way, butthead. No way you'd know a female that beautiful. Because she looks like some kind of movie star, wearing these old jeans and a baggy t-shirt, and her long hair is tied back, and she's probably sweating. But she still looks like a movie star. Like she has this glow, a secret spotlight that follows her around and makes her eyes light up. And I'm thinking, well, this improves the old neighborhood. You're thinking, yeah, right. The goon is barely out of 7th grade. Who does he think he is? All I'm saying, the fair Gwen had star quality, and even a total moron can see it. And the reason she looked familiar is, I must have seen her bringing Freak to daycare. Way back in the dark ages, because the next thing I notice is this crippled up yellow-haired midget kid strutting around the sidewalk, giving orders to the beards. He's going, hey you, doofus, yeah, you with the hairy face, take it easy with that box. That box contains a computer. You know what a computer is? I can't believe it. By then, I'm sneaking along the street to see what's going on, and there's this weird-looking little dude. He's got a normal-sized head, but the rest of him is shorter than a yardstick, and kind of twisted in a way that means he can't stand up straight, and makes his chest puff out. And he's waving his crutches around and yelling up at the movers. Hey, Gwen, one of the beards says, can't you give this kid a pill or something? He's driving us nuts. So Gwen comes out of the house and pushes the hair out of her big brown eyes, and she goes, Kevin, go play in the backyard, okay? But my computer. Your computer is fine. Leave the men alone. They'll be done soon, and then we can have lunch. By this time, I'm hunkering along in front of the place, trying to maintain a casual attitude. Except, like I said, my feet are going wild that year, and I keep tripping over everything. Cracks in the sidewalk, ants in the sidewalk, shadows, anything. Then, the strange little dude jerks himself around, and he catches sight of me, and he lifts a crutch and points it up at my heart, and he goes, identify yourself, earthling. I'm busy keeping my feet from tripping, and don't get it that it means me. I said, identify yourself, Earthling, or suffer the consequences. I'm like, what? And before I can decide whether or not to tell him my name, or which name, because by now I recognize him as the weird little robot kid from daycare, and maybe he remembers me as Kicker. Anyhow, before I can say a word, he pulls the trigger on that crutch and makes a weapon noise, and he goes, then die, Earthling, die. I motor out of there without saying a word, because I'm pretty sure he really means it. The way he points that crutch is only part of it. You have to see the look in his eye. Man, that little dude really hates me. He wants me to die. Chapter 3. American Flyer. Okay, back to the down under, right? My room in the basement. Scuttle into your dim hole in the ground, Maxwell, dear. Big goon like you, growing about an inch a day, and this midget kid, this crippled little humanoid, he actually scared you? Not the kind of scare that makes your knee bones feel like water. More the kind of scare where you go, whoa, I don't understand this. I don't get it. What's going on? Like calling me Earthling, which by itself is pretty weird, right? I already mentioned a few of the names I've been called, but until the robot boy showed up, nobody had ever called me Earthling. And so I'm lying on my mattress there, in the great down under, and it comes to me that he's right. I am an Earthling. We're all of us Earthlings, but we don't call each other Earthling. No need, because it's the same thing that in this country we're all Americans, but we don't go around to people and say, excuse me, American. Can you tell me how to get to the nearest 7-Eleven? So I'm thinking about that for a while, lying there in the cellar dark, and pretty soon the down under starts to get small, like the walls are shrinking, and I go up the bulkhead stairs into the backyard and find a place where I can check it out. There's this one scraggly tree behind the little freak's house, right? Like a stick in the ground with a few wimped out branches. And there he is, hardly any bigger now than he was in daycare. And he's standing there, waving his crutch up at the tree. I kind of slide over to the chain-link fence, get a better angle on the scene. What's he doing whacking at that crummy tree? Trying to jump up and hit this branch with his little crutch. And he's mad, hopping mad. Only he can't really jump. He just makes this jumping kind of motion. His feet never leave the ground. Then what he does, he throws down the crutch, and he gets down on his hands and knees and crawls back to his house. If you didn't know, you would think he was like a kindergarten creeper who forgot how to walk. He's that small. And he crawls real good, better than he can walk. Before you know it, he's dragging this wagon out from under the steps. Rusty red thing, one of those old American flyer models. Anyhow, the little freak is tugging it backwards a few inches at a time, chugging along until he gets that little wagon under the tree. Next thing, he picks up his crutch, and he climbs in the wagon, and he stands up, and he's whacking at the tree again. By now I've figured out that there's something stuck up in the branches, and he wants to get it down. This small, bright-colored thing looks like a piece of folded paper. Whatever it is, that paper thing, he wants it real bad. But even with the wagon there, there's no way he can reach it. No way. So I go over there to his backyard, trying to be really quiet, but I'm no good at sneaking up. Not with these humongous feet. And he turns and faces me with that crutch raised up like he's ready to hit a grand slam on my head. He wants to say something. You can tell that much. But he's so mad. He's all huffed up, and the noise he makes, it could be from a dog or something, and he sounds like he can hardly breathe. What I do, I keep out of range of that crutch and just reach up and pick the paper thing right out of the tree. Except it's not a paper thing. It's a plastic bird. Light as a feather. I have to hold it real careful, or it might break. That's how flimsy it is. I go, you want this back or what? The little freak is staring at me bug-eyed, and he goes, oh, it talks. I give him the bird thing. What is it, like a model airplane or something? You can tell he's real happy to have the bird thing back, and his face isn't quite so fierce. He sits down in the wagon, and he goes, this is an ornithopter. An ornithopter is defined as an experimental device propelled by flapping wings. Or you could say that an ornithopter is just a big word for a mechanical bird. That's how he talked, like right out of a dictionary. So smart you could hardly believe it. While he's talking, he's winding up the bird thing. There's this elastic band inside, and he goes, "Observe and be amazed, Earthling." And then he lets it go. And you know what? I am amazed, because it does fly just like a little bird, flitting up and down and around, higher than I can reach. I chase after the thing until it boinks against the scrawny tree trunk, and I bring it back to him, and he winds it up again and makes it fly. We keep doing that. It must be for almost an hour, until finally the elastic breaks. I figure that's it. End of Ornithopter. But he says something like, "All mechanical objects require periodic maintenance. We'll schedule installation of a new propulsion unit as soon as the Fair Guinevere gets a replacement." Even though I'm not sure what he means, I go, "That's cool. You live around here, Earthling?" "Over there." I point at the house. "In the Down Under." He goes, "What?" And I figure it's easier to show him than explain all about Graham and Grimm and the room in the cellar. So I pick up the handle to the American Flyer wagon and I tow him over. It's real easy. He doesn't weigh much. And I'm pretty sure I remember looking back and seeing him sitting up in the wagon, happy as can be. Like he's really enjoying the ride and not embarrassed to have me pulling him around. But like Freak says later in this book, you can remember anything, whether it happened or not. All I'm really sure of is he never hit me with that crutch. Chapter 4. What Frightened the Fair Gwen. Freak's not in my room for 10 minutes before he sets me straight on the Fair Gwen. He's able to hump down the steps by himself, except it makes him sort of out of breath. You can hear him wheezing, or I guess you'd call it panting, like a dog does on a hot day. He gets into my room, and I close the bulkhead door, and he goes, "Cool. You get to live down here all by yourself?" I eat upstairs with Grimm and Graham. Freak works himself up onto the foot of my bed and uses a pillow to make himself comfortable. It's pretty dim down here, only the daylight from one basement window, but it catches him just right and makes his eyes shine. "Graham must be your grandmother," he says. "Grimm would be, I suppose, a sobriquet for your grandfather, based on his demeanor." I go, "Huh?" Freak grins and pushes back his yellow hair, and he goes, "Pardon my vocabulary. Sobriquet means nickname, and demeanor means expression. I merely postulated that you call your grandfather Grimm because he's Grimm." "Postulate means..." "I know," I say, which is a lie, except I can guess what he means. Figure it out that way. "So how come you call your mom Fair Gwen of Air? Is that a nickname?" Freak is shaking his head. I can see he's trying not to let on that he's laughing inside. "Guinevere," he finally says, catching his breath. "The Fair Guinevere, from the Legend of King Arthur." "You know about King Arthur, right?" I shrug. The only King Arthur I know is the brand of flour Graham uses, and if I say that, I'll really sound like a butthead. He goes, "My mom's name is Gwen, so sometimes I call her the Fair Guinevere, or the Fair Gwen. King Arthur was the first king of England, way back when there were still dragons and monsters in the world. Arthur was this wimpy little kid, an orphan, and there was this magic sword stuck in a big stone, okay? The old king had died, and whoever could pull the sword from the stone proved he was the next king. All these big, tough dudes came from all over to yank at the sword, and they couldn't budge it. One day, this wimpy little kid tried it, when nobody was looking, and the sword slipped out like it was stuck in butter." "So he was the king, this little kid?" Freak nods. He's really into this story, and he's making shapes in the air with his hands. This is the first time for me, hearing Freak really talk. And right away, I know one thing. When he's talking, you can't take your eyes off of him. His hands are moving, and it's like he's really seeing it. The story about an old king. Arthur's magical sword is called Excalibur. And the Fair Guinevere is this pretty girl who becomes his queen. Fair, in those days, meant the same as beautiful does now. Anyhow, Arthur got bored just sitting around, so he invited all the knights of England to come live in the castle. They all ate supper at this round table, which is why they were called the Knights of the Round Table. Every now and then, King Arthur would send them off on a special secret mission, which in the old days they called a quest. They had to slay dragons and monsters and evil knights. I assume you know what a knight wears into battle. I think so, but I like hearing Freak talk, so I go, "Better tell me." And that's when I find out why he's so interested in some clanky old knights. Because Freak really lights up and he goes, "The knights were like the first human version of robots. They wore this metal armor to protect them and make them invincible. When I get my stuff unpacked, I'll show you the pictures. It's pretty amazing, really, that hundreds of years before they had computers, they were already attempting to exceed the design limitations of the human body." I go, "Huh." And Freak sort of chuckles to himself, like he expected me to go, "Huh." And he says, "The design limitations of the human body, you know. Like, we're not bulletproof, and we can't crush rocks with our bare hands, and if we touch a hot stove, we get burned. King Arthur wanted to improve his men, so he made them armor-plated. Then he programmed them to go out and do these quests, slay the dragons, and so on, which is sort of how they program robots right now." I go, "I thought there weren't any real robots, just in the movies." Boy, does that make his eyes blaze. Like, whoa, talk about laser beams. He's like fuming, so upset he can hardly talk. Finally, he gets control of himself, and he goes, "I suppose I must make allowances for your ignorance. On the subject of robots, you are clearly misinformed. Robots are not just in the movies. Robotics, the science of designing and building functional robots, is a huge industry. There are thousands of robot units presently in use, millions of them. They don't look like the robots you see in movies, of course, because they're designed according to function. Many robotic devices are in fact sophisticated assembly units, machines that put together cars and trucks and computers. For instance, the space shuttle has a robot arm." "Right," I say. "I saw that on TV." Freak sighs and rolls his eyes. "Ah, yes," he says. "Television, the opiate of the masses." For about the 11th time, I go, "Huh?" "Opiate. A drug," he says. "Massive. That means large and heavy. Thus, television is the drug of fatheads. Opiate of the massives." "You don't have a TV?" "Of course I have a television," he says. "How else could I watch Star Trek? Matter of fact, I watch tons of tube, but I also read tons of books, so I can figure out what's true and what's fake, which isn't always easy. Books are like truth serum. If you don't read, you can't figure out what's real." This time I don't say, "Huh," because then I might have to explain how I'm an LD, and reading books is the last thing I want to do, right after trimming my toenails with a lawnmower, gargling nails, and eating worms for breakfast. Of course, Freak has probably already guessed I'm a learning disabled, because he's had a look around my room, and it isn't exactly the public library. "I'll lend you some of my books," he says. "Cool," I say, like it's just what I've been waiting for. Another chance to prove I'm a butthead. Then we both hear it at the same time, this voice calling his name and sounding real worried. "The Fair Gwen," he says. "I gotta beam out of here." I go up and open the bulkhead door, and his mother is in the backyard, and she's looking at the little red wagon. She catches sight of me coming up out of the down under, and it's like somebody shot her, like she's scared out of her mind. "Kevin," she says, "I'm looking for a little boy." Freak is huffing and puffing as he humps himself up the steps, and the Fair Gwen grabs Freak and puts him in the wagon, and I swear, she almost runs home. Like if she doesn't get away quick, something really bad is gonna happen. Freak is in the wagon, and he's trying to look back at me, trying to shrug his shoulders and let me know he doesn't understand what got into the Fair Gwen. But I know. It's pretty simple, really. She's scared of me. Chapter 5. Spitting Image. There's a place I go in my head sometimes. It's cool and dim in there and you float like a cloud. No, you are a cloud. The kind you see in the sky on a windy day. The way they keep changing shape, except you can't really see it changing. It just sort of happens. And suddenly, you realize the cloud that looks like a big hand with fat fingers now looks like a catcher's mitt. Or a big soft TV set. Like that. Anyhow, I went there right after the Fair Gwen ran off with that look on her face, like, what was he doing with my poor little boy? Stealing him away in the wagon. What I do is lie on the floor under my bed, where you can just barely see the bed springs and stuff because it's so dark. And before long, I'm somewhere else, sort of floating. And it's so cool and empty in there, You don't have to think about anything. You're nothing. You're nobody. Nothing matters. You're not even there. Time out. Except this time, I can't stay as long as I'd like, because Graham is knocking on the door. Going, Maxwell, Max, are you there? Please answer me, dear. It's important. Yeah, right. But I wedge out from under the bed. There's getting to be less and less room under there. And I dust myself off and open the door. There's no lock. But Graham has this thing about waiting until I say come in. She makes a big deal about not intruding. Maxwell, she says. And she takes a little step inside the room. And you can tell she'd rather not be here. She makes this face because the place is dark and messy. And probably it smells like my socks or whatever. Max, dear, I'm sorry to bother you. You know I never come into the basement. But I just got a call from Gwen Avery, and I think it's important. Uh-oh, I'm thinking. Now the fair Gwen is calling up my Graham, probably to report a great hulking beast that lives in the cellar. And I close up inside, waiting for the worst. She called to say how sorry she was, Graham is saying. Huh? I guess she came to pick up her little boy. Is that right? You and Kevin were making friends? Making friends? What a wet idea that is. But Graham gets her feelings hurt pretty easy, so I don't actually say that. What I say is, yeah, I guess so. Graham is uneasy. I can see her eyes flitting nervously around the room, like she's crossing the border into a really foreign country. This is as good a place as any to mention that even though Graham is my grandmother, she doesn't look like a granny. She looks more like a mother. Because she was, as she always says, a mere child myself when my real mother was born. Well, I get the impression poor Gwen wasn't expecting to see you looking so big. And now she thinks she's offended you. Does that make any sense? I guess so. You know her, huh? Oh my, yes, says Graham. Gwen was a good friend of your mother's. They were both pregnant at the same time. Then later on, you and little Kevin went to the same daycare. Did you know that? I give a shrug because I don't really like Graham to know how much I remember about way back then. Graham is saying, she said, she especially wanted me to tell you this, Max. She said she's delighted that you and Kevin are going to be friends. That's the word she used. Delighted. And she's inviting you to supper. First thing, without thinking, I say, do I have to? Graham reaches out and she puts her hand on my shoulder, real light and feathery. You can feel how nervous she is just to touch me, and how it makes her uncomfortable to have to look up at me. Because did I mention I'm a lot bigger than Graham? Bigger than Grim, too? Bigger than most people? It's true. Graham says she feels bad about how she treated you, Maxwell, dear, and she wants to make it up to you. You don't have to go, but it would be the right thing to do. It was no big deal, I say. She just ran away is all. I guess I scared her. It wasn't you, Graham says. No? Then who was it scared her? Now she's got her tongue stuck, and you can see her swallowing in her throat, like her mouth is dry. I'll just leave that to Gwen, she says. She's quite a remarkable young woman, you know, raising that poor boy all on her own. He's not a poor boy, I say. You should hear him talk. I think the rest of him is so small because his brain is so big. Yes, says Graham. Well, well. Graham was always saying that. Well, well. Like it means something, which I guess it does to her. Anyhow, I agreed to have supper with Freak and his mom, even though the idea of it makes me feel tensed up, like there's a hand inside my stomach, and the hand is, you know, making a fist. Turns out to be not so bad. The fair Gwen, right away she's beaming at me, bouncing around the kitchen and talking a mile a minute, so fast the words kind of smush together. So did Susan excuse me your grandmother mentioned your mom and I were pals, that is? Until she got married, excuse me, I never could abide that man. I always thought he was crazy and scary. Is it okay to say that you won't be offended? It's like this delay while I sort it out. And then I go, yeah, Graham told me. And the stuff about her knowing my father and thinking he was sick in the head, I decide no comment is the way to go. You were the cutest little baby, Gwen says. I remember like it was yesterday. We were all of us living over in the tenements in those days, because the rent was so cheap, and we were all just starting out. Freak is on the floor, digging through the packing boxes for pots and pans and stuff. He's almost inside this box. All you can see is his funny little rear end sticking out. You'd think he was maybe 2 years old. That's how small he is. Until you notice where his leg brace makes a lump in his pants. From inside the box he goes, "Hey, Gwen, leave the guy alone, huh? You're going spastic." "Am I?" Gwen asks. She's at the counter, going through drawers and looking for spoons or whatever. "Sorry, Max. That is, I'm sorry we got off on the wrong foot. It's just, you know." Freak's head pops out of the box, and he's got this wicked know-it-all grin. What she means is, you're a spitting image of your old man. Gwen says, "Kevin, please," and her voice is real small, like she's embarrassed. "Yeah," I say, "everybody says that." "They do?" I shrug. Is it really such a big deal for a boy to look like his father? Which is typical butthead thinking, because of course it's a big deal, if your father happens to be in prison, which everybody in town knows about. It's not like there's any secret about what he did or why he's there, except everybody acts like it should be a secret. And the bigger I grow, and the more I look like my old man, the worse it gets. "You really knew him?" I say. "I mean, him and my mom, when they were together?" "Not very well," Gwen says. She's looking for a knife to slice open a pack of hot dogs. "I never saw much of your mom after they got married. He made it difficult for your mother to have any friends." There's a knife on the table, and I pick it up and hand it to the fair Gwen. She doesn't flinch away, and I decide she's okay. She's really pretty cool. "So," Freak is saying, "when do we eat? My fuel cells are depleted." Supper is great. The fair Gwen makes this really tasty potato salad with spices and stuff. Way better than the mushy stuff Graham makes. And we have hot dogs fried in a pan, with the buns toasted up buttercrisp just the way I like, and 2 kinds of relish, and 3 kinds of mustard, and red onions cut up real small. We sit out in the backyard eating from paper plates, and Freak tells robot stories that are so strange and funny I'm laughing like a maniac, and then I'm choking, and Freak is pounding me on the back. "Expel the object," Freak shouts out. "Regurgitate, you big moron," and he gives me another thump, and I cough up this yucky mess, but I'm still laughing so hard my nose is running. What a goon, except it really is funny, me trying to sneeze a hot dog through my nose, and we're both laughing like total morons. "This is great," Gwen says, looking at Freak and me. "I'm so glad we decided to move back, you know? I feel like we're all getting a fresh start." It's time to go home. Graham gets nervous if I'm not back before dark. Everything seems really great, just like Gwen says, except when I lie down on my bed, it hits me. Boom. And I'm crying like a baby. And the really weird thing is, I'm happy. Chapter 6. Close Encounter of the Turd Kind. 4th of July, right? Everybody goes nuts. The dads are getting drunk and having their cookouts, and the moms are trying to keep all the brats from blowing their precious little pinkies off with cherry bombs, and the kids are running wild through the backyards. It's like no rules apply, and that makes everything real edgy, if you know what I mean. Like, let's have a blast, and who cares what happens. Don't get the wrong idea. I love the 4th. It's just that people tend to get all choked up about firecracker holidays, and they don't see what's really going on, which, like I say, is the dad swilling beer and acting numb. That's the basic formula. Not that Grimm ever swills anything stronger than root beer. No way. The poison never crossed his lips, he likes to say, even though I've seen a picture of him in the army, and that sure looks like a bottle of beer in his hand. And he's got that same whacked-by-a-hammer grin that dudes always get when they're drinking. Anyhow, this is the first year I get to go to the fireworks without Grimm and Graham, which I never understood, because it's right down by the mill pond where I've been allowed to go for years. So why should it make a difference, just because about 1 million people show up to watch the rocket's red glare over that smelly pond? The deal this year is that I get to go with Freak, which Graham thinks is a good idea because she's afraid he'll get crushed or something. She actually thinks people are going to step on him, which just goes to show how brainless she can be sometimes, and scared of everything. I mean, nobody steps on little kids down there, so why should they step on Freak? Turns out the thing to worry about is not kid stompers, but beer swillers, like I mentioned before, because Freak and I are still a couple of blocks from the pond, just kind of easing our way along, when these punks start mouthing off. "Hey, you, Mutt and Jeff, Frankenstein and Igor. Don't look around. I'm talking to you, boneheads. What is this, a freak show? I know that voice. Tony D. They call him Blade. He's at least 17, and he's already been to juvie court 3-4 times. I heard he cut a guy with a razor. He almost died. And everybody says the best way to handle Tony D and his gang is you avoid them. Cross the street, hide, whatever it takes. Yeah, you, he goes, and he's doing this hippity walk, strutting along. He's got these fancy, cool cowboy boots with metal toes. Yeah, Andre the Giant and the Dwarf. Hold on a sec. I want a word with you. Only the way he talks, he goes, I want a word with ya. Except it's bad enough having to listen to the creep. I don't want to have to spell the dumb way he talks. Anyhow, big mistake. We stop and wait for Tony D, alias the Bad News Blade. Got any dudes? He asks, pretending like he's friendly. He's a couple of feet away, but you can smell the beer in his breath. Also, it smells like he ate something dead, for instance, roadkill. But maybe that's my imagination. Pay attention, Tony D says. I ask, did you got any? Freak, his chest is all puffed out and his chin looks hard, and he's looking right up at Tony D, and he says, got any what? Tony D has his hands on his hips, and his punkster pals are trying to get closer, working through the crowd. He leans over Freak and he says, Boomers, you little freak. M80s. Maybe a rack of cherry bombs. Is that what's making a lump in your pocket, huh? Freak starts to hump himself away, trying to walk faster than he really can, which makes his leg brace bump against the ground. Come along, Maxwell, he says over his shoulder. Ignore the cretin. Blade goes, Hey, what? And he moves right in front of Freak. Wanna say that again, little freak man? Freak says, Cretin. C-R-E-T-I-N. Defined as one who suffers from mental deficiency. Hearing how little tiny freak is dissing the fearsome Tony D, alias Blade, I can't help it. I laugh out loud. Tony D is looking up at me, and he's showing his white teeth. I swear they've been sharpened to look like vampire teeth. And I go, uh-oh, and start to get real cold inside. Real icy, because I can see that Blade is trying to make up his mind. Is he going to fight me, or is he just going to kill me quick? Just then, I hear the whoop of a siren, and like a miracle, this cop car comes out of nowhere, heading for the mill pond, and Blade takes one look, and he and his punksters are out of there, burning rubber in their Reeboks. Freak goes, whew, that was a close encounter of the turd kind. And it takes me a second to get the joke, but then I'm laughing, amazed he can be so cool about it, like it was no big deal that Tony D was after us. You can take him, right? He asks a couple of minutes later. I go, are you kidding? You can't just fight Blade, you have to fight his gang, too. You mean, you couldn't take him, and I was giving him lip? That's about the size of it. Freak goes, oh my god. And he's shrieking and laughing and whooping it up so loud that everybody's looking at us like we're total goons. Which isn't far from the truth. Freak hasn't got his crutch tonight, just the leg brace. And he's laughing so hard he falls down. Not that he has far to go. Anyhow, I pick him up and I'm amazed how light he is, like it's nothing for me to lift him. And maybe that's where I get the idea. Because later, when we're down by the pond and the first of the rockets is streaking up, 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 Freak is making a fuss because he can't see. There are so many people crowded around, all he can see are feet and knees. And people are lifting their little kids up to see the fireworks explode like hot pink flowers in the sky. And so I just sort of reach down without thinking and pick up Freak and set him on my shoulders. He's kind of trembly up there until he grabs hold of my hair to steady himself. And then the first really big rocket whams off a humongous thud I can feel in my stomach. And Freak is shouting, all right. And I know it's okay. He's not flipped out because I picked him up and put him on my shoulders like he was a little kid instead of possibly the smartest human being in the whole world. Magnesium! He shouts as the white sparkles glitter down over the pond. Potassium chlorate, as the shells go womp, 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 and everybody goes, ooh. Potassium nitrate, sulfur, aluminum. And after a burst of hot red fire in the sky, Freak tugs my hair and screams, copper! That's copper powder combusting with oxygen. And when the fire blossoms are flashing blue, he goes, good old strontium nitrate. And I'm thinking, whoa, is there anything this little dude doesn't know? At the end, like always, they have a thing they call the grand finale, when they just go nuts and let off everything at once, and it sounds like World War III, whizzing and banging and popping, and there's so much hot stuff falling from the sky you can hear it sizzling in the pond. Freak keeps on shouting out the names of chemicals and elements until the last spark dies in that scummy pond, and the crowd cheers, and then everybody tries to leave at once, like a bunch of morons. Chapter 7. Walking High Above the World. You ever notice how the smell of gunpowder makes you thirsty? Because after the fireworks, I'm aiming us for where the food carts are parked along the street, thinking about an ice-cold lemonade, how clean it will taste, and for a moment, I almost forget that Freak is riding on my shoulders. Amazing perspective up here, he's saying. This is what you see all the time. I'm not that big, I say. This way you're like 2 feet taller than me. Cool, he says. I love it. We're working our way through the crowd, and we're almost to the food carts when Freak tugs on my hair. Cretin at 2 o'clock, he says. Real urgent. 2 more at 3 o'clock. I go, huh? What? The Blade and his gang, Freak hisses. They've locked onto us. Their trajectory is converging. Go to the left, he says. Make it quick if you want to live. Too bad I'm a little confused about rights and lefts. If I don't think about it, I know. But if I have to think about it quick, my mind goes blank. Right, left. What does it all mean? Left, Freak says, and he kicks me with his little foot, like he's digging into a horse, and it clicks in my head. Go that way. Follow the feet. Faster, Freak is saying, and he's urging me on. It's lucky for me that little dude doesn't have any spurs. But I don't care. I just want to get clear of Blade. Warp factor 9, Freak is shouting. More speed, oh mighty beast. Now I'm running at full gallop, weaving through the crowd, and I don't even need to look back. All I have to do is follow the way Freak is kicking his feet, steering me. I'm pretty sure we're getting away until this punk comes out of nowhere. He's one of Blade's gang, and he's got this big, ugly grin. Over here, Tony. Got him cornered. What do? I say to Freak. He goes, I'm thinking. I can hear Blade before I can see him. Hear his wicked laugh, so mean and dirty it makes my stomach freeze up and my knees feel squishy. You, the freak. You and the giant retard. I'll cut you down to size. Dice and slice, baby. Freak showtime. And now I can see him. See that pointed white grin and his eyes so dark and cruel. And he's swaggering through the crowd. He's got us surrounded with punks. Everywhere I turn, there's another mean face trying to look as tough as Tony D. In a small voice, I say, tell me what to do. And Freak pats me on the shoulder and says, just give me a nanosecond to process the alternatives. Slice and dice. That's Blade, and he's reaching into his back pocket. Make it quick, I hiss, and then Freak is kicking my right shoulder, and I turn that way, and he's saying, go, go, and I run right over this punk. He's so surprised he loses his bubblegum, and he tries to grab my leg, but I kick free, and I'm running right and then left, running blind and just letting Freak decide which way we should go, because he must have a plan. A dude as smart as that. Which I'm right about. He does have a plan. Only the plan is to run out into the smelly mill pond and drown us both. Go on, he's shouting from up above my head. Trust me, we'll be okay. Blade is shouting too. And I can hear his feet pitter-pattering behind me, catching up. Warp speed, Freak is shouting, and he's kicking with both feet now, which means go straight. Head for the H2O. The pond is right ahead of me, and I'm sort of running along the edge, crunching over the bottles and cans and candy wrappers, and then I hear this zingy sound, and I just know that Blade is swinging a knife, cutting the air right behind us, and there's nowhere to go but into the pond like Freak wants me to. I almost lose it right there, taking that first step, because it's a gunky pond, and the mud is really oozy and deep, and it sucks right up to my knees. But I'm so scared of getting cut by Tony D, so scared he might bite me with those wicked teeth, I just keep going. There's this great, ugly sucking sound as my feet come back up out of the mud, and I stretch out as far as my legs will go, and I take another step, and I just keep going. I'm going so fast that the water is up to my chest before Freak gets my attention. He's tugging at my hair with both hands. Whoa, he's saying. Slow up, we did it. The mud is up around my knees, and it's real hard to turn around. Finally, I get so I'm facing back at the shore, and there's Blade, just his head above the water, and he looks all white and scared. Help, he's blubbering, choking on that dirty water, and that his punksters are splashing in to rescue him. Man, they can hardly get him loose, the way he's stuck deep in that mud, and before they drag him to shore, they're all covered with slime and mud. They're gasping like fish, almost too tired to cuss us out, but that doesn't last. Blade is covered with mud right up to his neck, which on him looks natural. He turns to his gang, who look as slimy as he does. Get some rocks. It's target practice time. What do we do now? I ask, because the mud is still sucking me down. It's over my knees now, and the water is right up under my arms, and even Freak's feet are getting wet. Wait, Freak says. The cavalry is coming. Can't you hear that bugle? I'm listening, but I can't hear anything except for Blade and his gang, and how they're scrambling around trying to find some rocks to heave at us. I can see Blade rearing back to throw, and the first one misses us. Can you move? Freak says. I don't think so. It's true. The mud is up over my knees, and I'm locked in place. I can't even fall down. That's how stiff it is. I'm like a big fence post, and everybody knows a fence post makes a good target. More splashes as the rocks fall short. At first, they're throwing stuff that's too heavy. Pretty soon, they smarten up, and Blade says, "Smaller rocks. Get me smaller rocks." And I know in my heart we're doomed. Then up above me, there's this really loud, high-pitched screech. Freak has his fingers in his mouth, and he's whistling. Real shrill and shivery, and so loud it almost hurts my ears. And then I see what Freak has been seeing all along. A cop car cruising real slow along the road around the pond, which is what they always do after the fireworks. Freak is whistling, and the cop car spotlight comes beaming around the pond until it settles on us. I'm blinking because the light is so bright, and Freak is making a fuss and waving his arms, and we hear the metal megaphone sound of a cop voice ordering us not to move. Like we could, even if we wanted. It's hard to see in the glare of a spotlight, but Freak tells me that Blade and his punks are running away. Like snakes on sneakers, Freak says. Officers, Freak is shouting into the white light. We request assistance. They finally have to use ropes to pull me out of there. Freak won't let go. He stays right where he is, on top of my shoulders, even when this cop in a boat tries to lift him off. And then we're up on the bank of the pond, and everybody is being real nice and giving us blankets and cokes and saying they know all about Tony D. They'll keep an eye on him. Don't you worry. Okay, boys, you better give us your names, and we'll call your mothers, this one cop is saying. And there's this other guy who is looking at me funny, and he says, Hey, isn't that Kenny Kane's boy? Must be. Old Killer Kane, is he still inside? Freak is still holding tight to my shoulders, and when they ask him for his name, he says, We're Freak the Mighty. That's who we are. We're 9 feet tall, in case you haven't noticed. That's how it started, really. How we got to be Freak the Mighty, slaying dragons and fools and walking high above the world. Chapter 8. Dinosaur Brain. It turned out to be a cool summer. I figured we'd get in trouble for running into the pond. It looked bad for a while, when the cops drove us home and I got out all soaking wet and covered with gook. And when Grim was hosing me down, he had this really pruny look on his face, like he was smelling something bad. But the cops made out like I was a hero or something, rescuing the poor crippled midget kid. So Grim listens to the cops, and then he gives me this weird look like, imagine my surprise. And he goes in the house, and then Graham comes running out in her nightgown with this big fluffy towel, and she really makes a fuss. Me rescuing Freak. What a joke, right? Except that's how it must have looked from a distance, because they never knew it was Freak who rescued me, or his genius brain and my big dumb body. Graham is there rubbing me with a towel, and her hands are shaking, and she's saying, Oh, I saw those blue lights and I thought the worst. And Grim is behind her looking at me real intense and shaking his head, and he's saying, Who'da thunk it, Mabel? Which is some kind of joke because Graham's name isn't Mabel. Anyhow, they take me inside, and the first thing Graham does is give me a bowl of ice cream. And Grim, he keeps shaking his head, and he goes, What this young man needs is a cup of coffee, real coffee. And then he gets busy putting the filter in the machine and measuring out the coffee and standing by it while it drips through. And he's got this stern look like he's thinking deep thoughts. By the time I polish off the ice cream, Grim is handing me coffee in a china cup from the set they never use. He gives me that cup like it's a really big deal. Maybe because I'm not allowed to drink coffee yet. And he's so grim-like and serious. I open my mouth to say, What's the big deal? You really think this is my first cup of coffee? Yeah, right. And something happens. And the words come out. Thank you, sir. And it's like I'm possessed or something. I have no idea where the things I'm saying are coming from, or why. I go, thanks for the towel, Graham, and the ice cream. Could I have sugar in the coffee? 2 teaspoons, please. And Graham claps his hands together and he says, of course you can, son. And it's like, whoa, because he never calls me that. Always Max or Maxwell, or that boy. Next thing, he's clearing his throat, and coughing into his fist. And Graham is looking at the two of us, and she gets this Graham-like glow. Like this is how it's supposed to be. The way things always happen on the Wonder Years. With the family getting all gooey and sentimental about some numb thing the bratty kid did while he's having all his wonderful years or whatever. Graham says, I want you to promise me something, Maxwell, dear. Promise me you'll keep away from that hoodlum boy and his awful friends. Nobody got hurt this time, but I shudder to think what might have happened. And Graham, bless his pointed little head, he goes, Maxwell can handle himself. Can't you, Max? Right. Max. Not son, which is okay by me. I can run, I say to Graham. I see Tony D, that's what I'll do. Good boy, Graham says. I thought because you're so much bigger than he is, well, you just do that, dear, you run away. He's not running away, Graham says, real impatient. He's taking evasive action, avoiding a confrontation. That's a very different thing, right, Max? I nod and drink my coffee without slurping, and decide it's better not to mention that Tony D carries a knife, and he's probably got guns, too. Because then Graham would only worry, and she's such a clunker when she's worried. Like I said, it turns out to be a pretty cool summer. Usually what I do is just hang around and look at my comic books and watch the tube, or go shopping with Graham if she really makes a fuss. I hate the beach, because the beach is stupid. The cool crowd looking sleek and tanned, and aren't we gorgeous? And because if you saw me lying on a blanket, you'd go, hey, why is that albino walrus wearing sunglasses? So mostly I just vegetate in the basement and pick my navel. To quote Grimm, Mr. Bellybutton Lint himself. Freak changes all that. Each and every morning, the little dude humps himself over and he bangs on the bulkhead. Wonka, wonka, wonka. He may be small, but he sure is noisy. Get out of bed, you lazy beast. There are fair maidens to rescue, dragons to slay. Which is what he says every single morning. Exactly the same thing, until it's like he's this alarm clock. And as soon as I hear the wonka, wonka, wonka of him beating the bulkhead, I know what's coming next. Fair maidens and dragons and Freak with that wake-up-the-world grin of his going, hurry up with the cereal. How can you eat that much, you big ox? Come on, let's do something. He's so full of ever-ready energy you can practically hear his brain humming, and he never can sit still. Ants in the pants, I say one morning when he's ready to yank the cereal bowl off the table. He's in such a hurry to do something, and he goes, what? And I go, you must have ants in your pants. And he gets this funny look, and he goes, that's what the fair Gwen always says. Did she tell you to say that? And I shake my head and finish the cereal real slow. And Freak goes, for your information, there are 2,247 known subspecies of Hymenopteran insects. Latin name for Misidae, and none of them are in my pants. Which cracks me up, even though I don't understand a word he's saying. I propose a quest, he says. We shall journey far to the east and see what lies there. By now, I know what a quest is because Freak has explained the whole deal. How it started with King Arthur trying to keep all his knights busy by making them do things that proved how strong and brave and smart they were. Or sometimes how totally numb. Because how else can you explain dudes running around inside big clunky tin cans and praying all the time? Which I don't mention to Freak because he's very sensitive about knights and quests and secret meanings. Like how a dragon isn't really just a big, slimy, fire-breathing monster. It's a symbol of nature or something. A dragon is fear of the natural world, Freak says, an archetype of the unknown. I go, what's an archetype? And Freak sighs and shakes his head and reaches into his knapsack for his dictionary. This is true. He really does keep a dictionary in his knapsack. It's his favorite book, and he pulls it out like Arnold Schwarzenegger pulling out a machine gun or something. That's the fierce look he gets with a book in his hands. Go on, he says, making me take the book. Look it up. And now I wish I hadn't said anything about this archetype dude because I hate looking up stuff in his stupid dictionary. Start with A, he says. I know that. A-R, he says. Just go along the A's until you come to A-R. Yeah, right. Easy for a genius to use the dictionary, since he already knows how to spell the words. And R's never look like backward E's to Freak. Which is the way they look to me sometimes, unless I really squint and think about it. Careful, he says. You'll bite off your tongue, and then we'll have to waste the day at the emergency room getting it reattached. Microsurgery is such a bore. Didn't anybody ever tell you that? Huh? I say. But I do close my mouth so my tongue doesn't stick out. I'm still looking in the dictionary for archetype, and I'm looking for words that are underlined with red ink, because that's what Freak does the first time he looks up a word. He makes a line under it, and you'd be amazed how many are underlined. There are whole pages like that, where he's looked up every single word. Finally, he spells out all the letters for me, and I find the stupid word. "There's nothing about dragons here," I say, squinting hard at the stuff under the word. "It just says pattern. So what is it? A sewing type of thing?" Freak has this disgusted look, and he takes the dictionary and he goes, "You're hopeless. Pattern is the first definition. I was referring to the second definition, which is much more interesting. A universal symbol or idea in the psyche expressed in dreams or dreamlike images." Like, that helps, right? I'm getting bored with the dictionary, so I pretend to understand, and Freak finally gives up, and he shakes his head and goes, "I don't know why I bother. Dinosaurs had brains the size of peanuts, and they ruled the Earth for 100 million years. Chapter 9, Life is Dangerous. So out we go. It's a habit by now, Freak riding up high on my shoulders and using his little feet to steer me if I forget where we're going. Not that we always know. Freak likes to make things up as he goes along. You think you're just walking down this ordinary sidewalk, and really you're crossing this dangerous bridge, the kind made of vines that hangs high up in the air over a deep canyon. And when Freak makes it up, it seems so real. You're afraid to look down, or you'll get dizzy and fall off the sidewalk. "Don't ever look down," he says. "Just keep your eyes closed." And then he puts his hands over my eyes and tells me to keep walking straight. "One foot," he says. "Now the next." I'm fighting to keep my balance, and his hands are making me dizzy. "One more step," Freak says. "Steady, steady. Now lift up your hoof. I mean your foot. There, we made it." And he takes his hands away, and I see we've crossed the street. "Go east," he says, when I get to the end of the block. "That way, mighty steed. Yonder lies the east." I go, "How do you know which way is east?" And then something is glinting in my eye, and Freak is showing me this little compass. "The official Cub Scout compass? That's a clever disguise, so you don't know how valuable it is," he says. "This is actually a rare and valuable artifact passed down from generations. Lancelot used it, so did Sir Gawain, and for a time, the Black Knight kept it on a chain next to his heart." I go, "So the Black Knight was a Cub Scout, huh?" And Freak laughs and says, "That way, we go to the east on a secret mission." We walk for miles, way beyond the pond and the playground and the school, and for a while we're going through this really ritzy neighborhood of big white houses and blue swimming pools. Freak keeps saying stuff like, "That's the Castle of Avarice, and yonder lies the bloated moat." And when we go under trees, he'll say, "Proceed with caution," or "All clear," depending on how low the branches come down. "We must be east," I say. "Have we got to yonder yet? Because my stupid feet are getting sore." But Freak pats me on the head and says, "Yonder always lies over the next horizon. You could look it up if you don't believe me." Oh, I believe you. On and on, block after block, through all these neighborhoods that Freak says are really secret kingdoms. I'll bet we've gone 10 miles at least, because my legs think it's 100. And even as light as Freak is, he's starting to feel heavy. "We're almost there," he says. "Turn at the end of the block." "Where is it we're going?" "You'll see," he says, "and you will be amazed." Ahead there's this busy intersection, cars whizzing by, and it all seems sort of familiar. "Can we stop for a Coke?" I say. "Grim gave me $1, big deal, but we can split it." Freak goes, "Then that shall be your reward, faithful steed. Tinted sucrose and bubbles of air. Onward, onward to the fortress." It turns out the fortress looks like part of a hospital, which it is. The regular hospital is around in front, and there's this new building added on out back. "Medical research," it says, over the door, and I know because I made Freak spell it out. "Does that mean they do experiments and stuff?" Freak says, "Indeed they do." "What kind of experiments?" I ask. "Can you keep a secret?" he says. "Do you swear on your honor?" "Sure, on my honor." Freak is really excited. He's shifting around on my shoulder so much, I'm afraid he'll fall off. "That's not good enough," he says. "You need to swear by blood." "You mean like cut myself?" "Well, no," he says, and you can tell he's thinking about it real hard. "An actual incision is not necessary. It's the same thing if you just spit on your hand." "Huh?" "Saliva is like blood without the red," he says. "Do as I say. spit in your hand. So I spit in my hand, just a little drop. But Freak says it doesn't matter how much, a single molecule would work. Because it's the principle of the thing. Now put your hand over your heart, he says. I put my hand over my heart. Now swear in your heart that the data you are about to receive will be divulged to no one. I swear. Freak bends down, and he's got his hand cupped around my ear, and he's whispering. Inside the research building is a secret laboratory called the Experimental Bionics Unit. The unit's mission is to develop a new form of bionic robot for human modification. What's that? I say. Shh. Speak of this to no one. But at some future time, as yet undetermined, I will enter that lab and become the first bionically improved human. I still don't know what it means, I say. Bionics. And please don't make me look it up in the dictionary. Bionics, Freak says. That's the science of designing replacement parts for the human body. You mean like mechanical arms and legs? That's ancient history, Freak says. The bionics unit is building a whole new body, just my size. Yeah? What'll it look like? A robot? A human robot, Freak says. Also, it will look a lot like me, only enlarged and improved. Yeah, right, I say. Let's go home, my feet are tired. Freak tugs hard at my hair. True, he says, with his voice getting high and excited. I've been in there, in the special unit. I have to go every few months for tests. They've taken my measurements, analyzed my blood and metabolic rates. They've monitored my cardiac rhythms and my respiratory functions. I've already been x-rayed and CAT scanned and sonogrammed. They're fitting me for a bionic transplant. I'm going to be the first. I can tell he really means it. This isn't a pretend quest, or making houses into castles, or swimming pools into moats. This is why we came here, so Free could show me where he's been. The place is important to him. I understand this much, even if I still don't understand about bionics, or what it means to be a human robot. Will it hurt, I ask, getting your parts replaced? Freak doesn't answer for a while, and then he says in his stern, smart voice, sure it will hurt, but so what? Pain is just a state of mind. You can think your way out of anything, even pain. I'm pretty worried about the whole deal, and I go, but why do you want to be the first? Can't someone else be first? Isn't it dangerous? Life is dangerous, Freak says, and you can tell he's thought a lot about this. After a while, he kicks me with his little feet and says, home.